True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This holiday season, give the gift of safety with Saber, the number one brand of pepper spray used by police and consumers worldwide. Saber offers maximum strength pepper spray and gel, as well as some other great devices to keep everyone safe this season and throughout the year. Their attention-grabbing personal alarms are audible up to 1,000 feet away. They also have easy-to-install home security options, great for those of us who aren't very handy around the house. Go to saberred.com/truecrimebrewery and use code TRUECRIME to get 20% off your order. That's saberred.com/truecrimebrewery.
And I'd like to tell you about MyFit jeans. These jeans are made from the softest fabric called Flex-Tech denim, and they're designed to fit all women. And that's for real. Whether you're at your fittest or you're having a bloated day, MyFit jeans will conform to your curves and feel really good. I love their wide waistband too, which prevents any chance of a muffin top. You're going to love MyFit jeans, and now they're offering our listeners an exclusive deal. Buy one pair, get 15% off, and if you buy two pair, you get 50% off the second pair as well. Just go to myfitjeans.com and enter code BREWERY for your 15% off your first pair and 50% off the second pair. That's myfitjeans.com and promo code BREWERY. Then let me know what you think, because I really like them. The Daniels family lived on Dasher Street in the town of Santa Claus, Georgia. Their one-story red brick house, with a big chimney protruding from the front, was nestled snugly at the end of a cul-de-sac. For Kim Daniels, this was her dream home. Kim was a drug addict, living out of her car when Danny Daniels helped her fight off her addiction and fell in love with her. Kim regained custody of her three children, and she and Danny were married. Danny had a teenage daughter, too, and the couple took in three foster children they planned to adopt. Kim wanted to give these children the childhood that she never had. One cool December night in 1997, the Daniels family was destroyed by a mass shooting that is now known as the Dasher Lane Massacre. Four family members were killed, three children kidnapped, and two children were inexplicably spared. The village of 300 residents that has been named for Father Christmas and displayed a sign declaring itself the city that loves children was rocked by this tragedy. And when the killer was found, everyone in Santa Claus was forever changed. Join us at the Quiet End on this cool December evening for the Santa Claus murders.
And we have a nice beer today. It's a wild ale called Southerly Love from Creature Comforts, which is right up the road in Athens, Georgia, home of the University of Georgia, the Bulldogs. Southerly Love's a pale yellow appearing beer with a big, huge, snowy white head. A sweet honey and lemon aroma, a little bit of sourness, vinegary, as wild ales and sours should be. Got a lot of fruit in the taste. Pears, apples, a little bit of lemon, very nice. And it's tart and sour, as you'd expect.
Sounds good.
And again, like most of these beers, it's pretty carbonated, so it's a lively beer and nice and crisp in your mouth. A nice beer.
All right, let's open it up.
Okay.
So here at the Quiet End, it's not going to be quiet for long. They have the 9 o'clock karaoke tonight, which has a Christmas theme.
Wow, so we're going to sing Christmas carols?
Well, I don't know if we'll hang around for it. We'll see how we're doing. I'll definitely watch, though. I don't know if it's carols or if it's more like Mariah Carey-type Christmas songs they're singing, but it should be fun.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the karaoke people here, they're like experienced, good singers. It's not just drunk people at the microphone sounding terrible.
Well, that's me.
Well.
Maybe not the drunk part, but the sounding terrible part. So I'll be an observer.
Yeah. Well, you don't really sound terrible. You just always sound like you're kind of talking more than singing.
Good compliment.
Which is okay.
All right.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and start our story today?
I will. So Santa Claus, Georgia, was founded in 1941 by a local pecan farmer named C.G. Green and his wife. So like many people down there at that time, he was a pecan farmer, and he wanted something to make his pecan store stand out from the other ones. A lot of competition there. So Mr. Green decided that since everyone loved Christmas, he would use that as his hook to get people to stop at his store on U.S. Highway 1. Maybe strangely, maybe not, the idea turned out to be a good idea. So that was the start of Santa Claus, Georgia. Streets in the little town were renamed to reflect the new name of the town. So we had Candy Cane, Dasher, Rudolph, things like that. These people went all out.
Well, they did. They even began keeping their Christmas decorations up all year long, which is a little strange, but they were into it.
They did, and it was very important to have your Christmas cards postmarked Santa Claus, Georgia. So post office would get inundated in Christmas time of the year. So they could stamp the cards with
that
postmark.
So people would actually drive there.
People would drive there, or they would ship their cards to the post office and say, please stamp these.
I didn't know you could do that.
Or postmark them.
Okay.
So Santa Claus is located in Toombs County. That's T-O-O-M-B-S, not T-O-M-B-S, although
okay.
It's pronounced the same.
Sure.
And there's all sorts of little stories about Toombs, which we'll talk about a little. So it's in kind of the low country of Georgia. It's about 75 miles west of Savannah, called the Coastal Empire. And it's most famous now for its sweet Vidalia onions, which we love. So ironically, even with a town called Santa Claus, the county carries the nickname Bloody Toombs. The county has a long history of violence. Some of it is racial in nature. And the violence has continued into the present time. Not just the murders we'll talk about today, but in 1991, a pecan farmer was robbed and murdered by two acquaintances. 1995, a young couple who became obsessed with the film Natural Born Killers killed an elderly gentleman and stole his truck. Then in 1997, there was the Tomato Patch murder, which involved a grandson killing his sleeping grandfather after years of physical and sexual abuse.
That's a lot of murders for a small area.
That's a little small area. And then there's another facet of life in Toombs County, and that's voodoo, referred locally as root. So we know voodoo's always played an important role in Georgia's past, both for blacks and whites. So there's no real racial divide in voodoo. Powders and potions made from various roots can be used to cast spells. And then in traditional voodoo, it was considered an honor to be entered by a spirit, or a loa, that will guide the person down the right path.
That's some superstitious shit there, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And these people are Christian as well, or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
The voodoo is kind of the secondary stuff.
All right, sure.
But yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting. It's an interesting makeup of the place.
Yeah, nice little background. I didn't know that stuff. So Kim and Danny Daniels lived on Dasher Lane in Santa Claus. And Danny was a postman, and Kim was a stay-at-home mom. They had five children in their blended family, and they'd opened their home up to foster children as well. They were held in high regard in Santa Claus for their selfless devotion to all of these children, and they lived in a large home. It had two ponds and plenty of acreage for the kids to play on, so a really nice place for a kid to grow up. Kim's story is a really interesting one. Her father was murdered for stealing chickens when she was 3 years old, and shortly after that, her mother abandoned Kim and her siblings. The children were separated and Kim was shuttled in and out of foster homes, 17 in 1 year and 52 altogether.
17 in 1 year to me is just mind-boggling. She wasn't even in some of these for a month.
Yeah, that's terrible. When she was 12, she was taken in by Mary Grace and Simi Driggers, and their home provided some stability that was unknown to Kim. They adopted her, and she took their last name, but still she struggled. She was defiant and constantly testing her limits. She ended up dropping out of high school and became addicted to drugs and alcohol. Then she married at age 21 and had a baby girl, Brandy, in 1985. But Kim could not grasp the idea of motherhood. I mean, she'd never really had much of a role model. Her husband divorced her and was awarded custody of Brandy, which was, you know, very depressing for Kim, and it seemed to drive her deeper into her addictions. Kim moved in with another addict, and she had another baby girl, Amber, in 1986. Then she had twins, Bryant and Brooke, in 1989.
Yeah, this is with the guy she moved in with.
Mm-hmm. Well, the father of the children left, though, after the twins were born, leaving her alone, unemployed, and addicted to drugs. So her three children were removed from her care, and Kim moved to a trailer park in Lyons, Georgia, where she continued to be on a downward spiral. Still, she vowed that somehow she would get her babies back. And her first steps to redemption arrived in the spring of 1992, when Kim found herself standing in front of the Mount Vernon Pentecostal Church. Christy Wood, the wife of the Reverend, knew Kim from the community. Christy's husband, the Reverend Ray Wood, wanted to help her. When Kim slipped into the church that spring day, Reverend Wood welcomed her and said she had found her way to the church for a reason. So Kim dined with the Woods that night and talked with them about getting her life together and getting right with God to get her babies back in her life.
And it's a testimony to her that she succeeded.
It is, because she didn't have a lot of help.
No, she really didn't.
No.
And she had her church, but the church was a tremendous help to her. And the minister and his wife, or the reverend and his wife, became very good friends and helped put Kim on the right path.
So that's great. It's an instance when religion is really a good thing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So over time, the energy that Kim was drawing from the church replaced what she had been experiencing with drugs and alcohol. And she succeeded in that. So she's, like I said, getting to be on the right path. Still had some obstacles to overcome. Now the first one, most pressing, was that she had to appear in court because she had assaulted a police officer.
Whoops.
Yeah, not a good
drawback.
Idea.
Yeah.
But she prayed. She got guidance from the Woods, and she appeared in court remorseful and sincere, and ended up getting probation. So she thought this was the first miracle that God had provided in her life, because Kim was going to court figuring she's going to go to jail.
Mm-hmm, you know, sure.
Assault a police officer, they don't take kindly to that stuff.
Sure.
But there she was. Then the next obstacle she had was finding a job. And this proved to be a little more difficult because the unemployment rate in Toombs County was quite high. In fact, it was twice as high as the national average.
Well, I mean, it's one of those towns without a lot to do.
Exactly.
But finally, she did find a job making plastic food containers, and she did well at her job.
She did. A good hard worker. She is well liked by fellow employees. Looking quite good right now.
And she had a goal to get those kids back.
She did.
You know, she didn't want the kids to end up having a life like her, being in different foster homes, which was what was happening, which must have been really hard for her to accept.
I would think, you know, she certainly didn't sound like she'd had a great experience in her foster homes.
Right. So thinking that her kids might go through the same stuff must have really been a motivating factor. Now, she was off drugs and alcohol, and as her sobriety lengthened, she began planning how to regain custody of her children, coming up with a concrete plan. She was awarded custody of her oldest child, Amber, but this didn't go well because Kim still had no idea how to parent. So after a few days, Amber was returned to foster care. But with more time and continued sobriety, Kim felt like she had learned to be a better parent. I'm hoping that she probably took some of the parenting classes they usually offer.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. So she did well with Amber this time. And 3 months later, she was awarded custody of her twins, Brooke and Bryant. So she's sober, she's employed, and she's reunited with her children. These are huge accomplishments.
Yeah. When you think about 3 years previously, or something like that, 2 or 3 years, where she had just been basically on her way to killing herself.
Yeah.
You know?
Hopeless.
And now she's clean and sober, she's employed. She has her kids.
Right. And she was very resolute in staying that way. She refused to go out on dates with men because she didn't want to jeopardize her progress. And one man there was, however, drew her interest, and he was a good guy. And that was Danny Daniels. Now, like we said, he was a rural mailman, and he had many of the same interests as Kim, raising children and their religion. Danny had been married previously, and he and his wife had adopted a baby girl. That marriage broke up, and Danny got custody of his daughter, Jessica, who was 11 years old at that time. Kim and Danny dated and attended church together. As they spent more time with each other, they found that their children also enjoyed being together, playing together, hanging out. So they were married in the Pentecostal church on December 3rd, 1992, and moved into Danny's house. Now, things weren't perfect, of course. It was a challenge for Kim to learn how to be a full-time wife and mother with all these kids. It's a big change. But she succeeded at it quite well. Danny ended up adopting Amber, Brooke, and Bryant, and at least Amber would say that she was thrilled to have this stable male figure in her life. Danny's daughter Jessica was a great big sister to them, and Kim's oldest Brandy, who lived with her father, visited quite often and was welcome in the home. So Danny was a good guy who treated her kids the same way he would treat his own kids.
Yeah, it was almost like a perfect storm. Right?
These two were really meant for each other.
These two fit so well together.
And Kim eventually confided one of her dreams to Danny. She said, "I want to open up our house to foster kids and be foster parents." You know, this was something near and dear to her. Kim and Danny took the 10-week course to become foster parents, and they opened their home to the children. The news about how good the Daniels family were as foster parents was really making its way around Toombs County, and they were in high demand. One day, a social worker asked Kim if she could take in a 10-year-old little girl named Joanna Mosley. Joanna needed a lot of attention, more than the other foster kids. And the Daniels were really up to the task. They had put their all into this. So with time, Joanna thrived in the care of the Daniels. She did miss her mother, of course, and her half-brother, Jerry Scott Heidler. Kim took Joanna to visit her mother and her brother, who was introduced to her as Scott Taylor.
Yeah, I don't know why.
I guess he was going by that name, Scott Taylor.
Yeah, well, and he'd been in trouble. So I'm thinking that maybe he didn't want him to get the wrong idea about him.
Well, maybe, but where'd the Taylor name come from?
I don't know.
The mother's name was Latrell Mosley.
Yeah, well, it was Latrell Heidler.
Sure.
And then it became Mosley.
She remarried?
Yeah, okay. But yeah, the only thing I can think of for him to be introduced as Scott Taylor was that he didn't want anybody to know that he was Jerry Scott Heidler.
Because he had a record?
Because he'd been in trouble with the police.
But they attended church services with the Daniels, and the more time they spent together, the more Kim could see that Jerry had some problems with drugs and alcohol. After Joanna left foster care and returned to her mother, the Daniels family offered Scott Taylor the chance to live with them and get his life back on track. Now, she really wants to help people who are in similar situations to what she was in, so I'm sure she could see this in him.
Yeah, there's no question. She really wanted to help him and thought, given her past history, that she'd be a good choice to help.
Which I guess she would have been, but he didn't really seem to do that well. Obviously,
no.
He went off the track again.
We'll talk about that, but yeah, they never could really get through to him.
Now, do we know how old he was at this time?
When they first met him, he was 19 or so.
Oh, so he's pretty much grown then.
Yeah.
He's not a child.
No, he wasn't. But he was kind of a special kid. Had a lot of difficulty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the mother, Latrell, had a lot of difficulties too.
Yeah, well, they said he was very socially awkward. Like he carried a mouse around with him for a while.
Yeah, we'll hit some of those highlights.
Okay.
Yeah, but he had an imaginary mouse, not a real mouse.
Oh, gee. Well, that's even stranger, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he talked to it. Joanna, the daughter, who was in foster care at the Daniels, did quite well there. But like a lot of times with the other kids in Latrell's household, mom was a pretty demanding person. And she ended up not following through with a lot of recommendations, saying that the kids would be better off with her than in a foster home. So Joanna could have stayed longer with the Daniels.
Sure.
But she was kind of summoned back home.
Oh, okay. All right, well, here is probably as good a time as any to take a little break for our sponsors.
Sure.
Today's episode is sponsored by Mira Books and Hunting Annabelle by Wendy Hurd. Sean Sa is done killing. After serving 3 years in a psychiatric prison, he's determined to stay away from temptation. But he can't resist Annabelle. Beautiful, confident, incandescent Annabelle. Who alone can see past the monster to the man inside? The man he's desperately trying to be. But then Annabelle disappears. Sean is sure she's been kidnapped. He actually witnesses her being taken firsthand. But the police are convinced that Sean himself is at the center of the crime. And Sean must admit, his illness has caused him to lose time before. So what if there's more to what happened than he's able to remember? Though haunted by the fear that it might be better for Annabelle if he never finds her, Sean just can't bring himself to let go of her without a fight. To save her, he'll have to do more than confront his own demons. He'll have to set them loose. This is a chilling, deeply suspenseful page-turner that's set in the 1980s. Hunting Annabelle by Wendy Hurd is available now wherever books are sold. Give in to temptation today.
That sounds like an interesting book.
Doesn't it? Sounds like fun.
It does. I'll have to look into that. This podcast is also brought to you by ADT. And we've talked about their home security systems. They're good people.
It's great stuff.
ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection. There are a vast number of things you can do with your secure smart home, like turndown service. This is an ADT automation that arms your system, locks your doors, and turns down your lights and thermostat. Quite nice. Or worry-free getaway service. This lets you arm your system, lock up, and set lighting schedules before you leave on vacation. Now, Jill and I went up to Albuquerque last weekend just to hang out there and see what was going on.
Had fun.
Had a good time, but we used this getaway service, and it was fantastic. We really appreciated it.
Well, it's really nice to be able to go away and have a good time without worrying about what's going on back home.
Exactly. And all these are controlled from the ADT app or at the sound of your voice. And backed by 24/7 protection. Best of all, at least in my view, you don't have to worry about installing and configuring your system. ADT will do it for you.
Those nice boys came over and did that, didn't they?
They did, fortunately. Otherwise, we'd still be
playing with it, yeah.
Non-functioning alarm system. So just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
Great. So this Jerry Scott Heidler spent much of his childhood in Alma, Georgia.
Alma's like half an hour or so from Santa Claus. They're all in the same locale, basically.
And all rural?
Yes.
Well, when he was 4 years old, he was discovered to have a congenital heart disease, and he needed surgery to repair his mitral valve. The surgery was a success, but it was often used as an excuse for Jerry in later years. Now, how would that work? Would there be some leftover problems after that? I thought people were pretty normal after that.
They are, generally.
Okay.
So the surgery was an excuse, not a reason. I can't do this because I've had heart surgery. Helped lower expectations of Jerry.
Did his mother teach him that?
Yeah.
Well, that's not good.
They both taught it.
So his mother, Latrell, I'm not super impressed with her from what I've heard so far.
You'll be less impressed as you go through this.
Okay. So Latrell came from a large family that was often in trouble with the police, and she actually got married when she was only 15, and that marriage lasted only a few months. So her and her husband at that point had one child, Ralph Elrod Jr., who was raised by his father when they got a divorce. Then when she was 18, Latrell married Jerry's father, George Heidler, and they had four kids, George Jr., Steve, Lisa, and Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry was the youngest.
Okay, so when Jerry was 8, his father left the family. So Latrell was left with 4 kids. And I don't think she was really earning any money. She didn't have a career to help her support these kids.
No, she had nothing.
And she became involved with another man named Lawton Mosley. And they got married in 1986. But Lawton, he was kind of just a piece of shit type of guy, right?
He was just an absolutely miserable human being.
Mean, abusive, drunk?
Both mentally and physically.
Well, it wasn't long before the household was in deep distress. Steve was in the county jail for threatening to beat Lawton with a table leg, and George Jr. was hospitalized for alcoholism at age 16. The family became involved with the Department of Family and Children's Services, and when Steve was released from jail, he began to show some really frightening behavior. He threw knives at other family members, and at night he would yell and scream. Every morning he beat up Lisa and Jerry. So, wow, that sounds like a disaster.
And this, the nighttime stuff was just no apparent rhyme or reason, just screaming and carrying on and keeping the whole household awake.
So this was mental illness. I mean, really, it had to be, right?
It is.
This is so sad.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is that these kids keep coming back to their home.
Well, I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to try for, though, is family reunification? That's kind of how it works.
It is, but...
But maybe this wasn't the best home for that.
It wasn't the best home for any of these kids.
Well, he also had a lot of trouble in school, which isn't surprising. He was held back in both kindergarten and first grade. He was disruptive in class, and he didn't get along with his classmates. One teacher even put up a screen around his desk so he could be less disruptive. Yeah, that doesn't sound helpful.
No, but he figured that out. He would stand on his desk and throw papers and stuff at the other kids.
How sad.
So he could see over the screen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm reading this stuff and thinking, this is just a recipe for failure with this kid.
It really is. Yep. Well, he underwent psychological testing, which showed he had learning difficulties and, of course, attention issues. And he continued to have the difficulties in school. In 1986, his little sister Joanna Mosley was born. And this only added to the chaos in the household, as you can imagine. They moved all the time because they couldn't pay their rent, there was never enough food in the house, and the parents were either drinking or fighting, getting drunk, abusive relationship. It was just disaster. It's like shameless, but not funny.
And that's a good analogy.
Yeah, it's just horrible.
It really is. I mean, it's just I'm reading it and thinking and cringing at the same time. It's just horrible.
Well, he committed his first crime when he was only 11. He broke into a neighbor's trailer, stealing money and soda. Appearing in court, he was given probation for a year and ordered to live with some other relatives. So he moved in with his paternal aunt and uncle, and for a while he seemed to kind of settle down. Then his mother began this period of harassment of the aunt and uncle, which culminated in him being moved back to his home, then moved into foster care with the Johnson family.
Yeah, so here he's bouncing back and forth, and he's like 11 years old.
Right. I just can't imagine. Can you imagine being a kid and not having a home with a parent?
No.
Really got to be really hard. But it was recommended at that point that a more permanent arrangement might be beneficial for him. So they did a test stay that was started at the home of Sylvia Boatwright, who was a pretty caring foster mom.
And she was kind of like one of the all-star foster parents in the area.
So single?
She was single. She had a daughter who helped. The daughter was a pharmacist or a pharmacy tech or something like that. But mom and daughter Boatwright were like the creme de la creme in the area for fostering kids.
So why did he only last there for about a week?
Because he was so difficult. Miss Boatwright said, I can't do this. So he got returned to the Johnsons.
So the Johnsons. His behavior got worse at the Johnsons' house too, though.
Yeah.
And there he complained that the other foster kids were picking on him, which could have been true, right? He was kind of an odd kid.
He was a very odd kid. Very non-communicative. If you talked to him, he'd never make eye contact. He'd look at the floor, look anywhere except right at you. And wouldn't answer. I mean, if you talked to him, you weren't sure he heard what you were saying. He'd mumble or he'd say, and that was it.
Okay.
So he had no communication skills whatsoever.
Wow.
So yeah, I could see where maybe he would be picked on because he certainly was a weird little kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he also demonstrated some voodoo rituals while he was there, which he said that he'd learned from his mom, his biological mom. So finally, the Johnsons had enough of him, and they returned Jerry to DFCS. So they were unable to find placement for him and returned him to his mother and stepfather. Is that smart?
They had no place else?
Well, geez, aren't there like, I know there aren't really orphanages, but there are places where kids can stay.
Yeah, probably. But just think about this. Here's this 11-year-old kid who is arrested for thieving, and he goes to a foster home. They can't take care of him, so he goes to another foster home. The recommendation is to be in a more permanent home, so he goes to a third foster home as a trial, fails the trial, goes back to the second foster home, and gets kicked out of there and goes back to his mother.
Well, he has no consistent person that believes in him.
This is five different places in a short amount of time.
Well, how can he have any love for himself when there's not a consistent person loving him as a child? I mean, that's a basic thing that we all need.
We sure do. And he wasn't getting it.
No, not at all. Well, that didn't last long. I don't know what happened back with his mother and stepfather, but I bet it was a nightmare. So he found himself back with DFCS again, and Mrs. Boatwright gave in and took him back in to try again. But he was a big challenge. This is when he adopted the imaginary pet mouse, right? And he was talking to it.
He would talk to it. And this is when I think the Green Mile had come out.
Mr. Jingles.
Right. Or had come out. And yeah, that's maybe where he got the pet mouse idea.
Well, that's not the worst thing in the world, right?
No.
You have an imaginary friend. Kids do that. Maybe he's a little old for it, but he's got to be stunted by all he's been through.
Well, absolutely. Emotionally, he was many years younger.
Of course.
Than his actual age.
Well, he did poorly in this new special school they put him in and was transferred to another school. There's just no consistency. And in his psychological evaluation, his doctor wrote, he has not learned to express emotion adaptively and appears to be harboring emotions within himself, which may be discharged in self-threatening, unmodulated ways, including threatening aggressive behavioral displays. There are indications as well that he may experience conflict in development of his identity. So his prognosis was guarded. I kind of feel like we're just creating a bit of a monster.
Well, again, here we have this last sentence, prognosis is guarded.
This is
an 11-year-old kid. And for an evaluator to say that, you're thinking this kid must be hopeless.
Jeez. Imagine having that job to deal with these kids all the time. How depressing.
Special people.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jerry was started on Ritalin, which was pretty normal at the time, but there wasn't much benefit from that. And his mother, Latrell, began to harass the Boatwright family and threaten them with voodoo spells. So Jerry spoke with his therapist about how confused talking about voodoo made him. And Latrell eventually hired an attorney after a court hearing, and Jerry was sent back to live with his mother. Now, here's a mystery to me. I'm going a little off track here, but a lot of these moms that lose custody of their kids because they're horrible moms want to get them back, but they don't want to do right by them. It's like a pride thing almost.
Yeah.
What do you think?
No, I think that's a good way to put it, that you don't feel like you're a mother unless you have your kids with you.
But then you're not even trying to be a good mother at all.
Well, I think that might be secondary to them, just to be able to say, I have custody of my kids. That's better than if you don't have custody of your kids.
And the horrible cynic deep within me says, well, maybe there were some benefits involved with having a kid in the house, too. She probably got some money from the government.
Yeah, she would get Social Security payments.
Because he was disabled?
Yeah.
So that could be part of her motivation right there. I hate to say it, but...
No, it could.
Shitty people think that way.
You got to have some money to be able to buy the booze and the drugs.
So I guess that's why she was trying to get him back. Pride and maybe the benefits is all I can think of.
Yeah, now even when he's back here, and again, this is still at age 11 or so.
Yeah.
His behavior was continuing to deteriorate. So, and this is where we started seeing those huge warning signs about severe psychopathology. He picked at his arms and legs, you know, making sores. He set fires. That's one of those big red flags.
That's in the serial killer checklist.
He began to torture cats and small animals.
That's really bad too, yep.
And one cat, one of his cats, or the family cats, he buried alive and it died. Then he dug it up, cut its head off, and put the head on a stick.
Well, gee, this is just like Edmund Kemper did things like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, just before his 12th birthday, after being home for a few months, Jerry tried to kill himself by a hanging. Luttrell saw him dangling from a tree branch and cut him down. Then 2 days later, he tried to kill his sister Joanna. He was hospitalized in Savannah for 2 months. And his behavior improved. Then he went home on a weekend pass. And Luttrell decided that he was well, and she wouldn't bring him back to the hospital, which yes, the hospital was doing him some good.
It was. So he basically was signed out against medical advice.
Stupid.
Because they expected him back.
Right. Well, by the time school started in the fall, Jerry had reverted back to the same old disturbing behavior that got him admitted in the first place. And he started to speak about killing himself as well as his family. He wanted to kill animals. And he spoke profanely. He had visual and auditory hallucinations. And he spoke about voodoo again, which I feel like his mother's getting that into his head. He was extremely hyperactive and restless, unable to sit still. And then he missed many appointments with his therapist because his mom just didn't get him there. Now, I don't know what her challenges were. She probably didn't have a car or something. But still, this is really important.
She did have a car.
Well, then what's the problem?
But either she didn't have money for gas, this is her story, or she wasn't well and was physically unable to drive him to his appointments. There was always an excuse.
Well, I would think that would be part of her keeping him at home would be that he has to make his appointments.
Well, you're right.
Starts missing his appointments, he should go back.
I would make that a requirement.
Yeah.
But it wasn't.
Well, he got into an argument with his brother George Jr. and tried to kill him with a rifle.
Yeah, he actually shot at him. Fortunately, he missed.
Well, the warning signs here are pretty heavy duty. But
yeah.
Things aren't happening.
Yeah.
Then his trips on the school bus were very disastrous. So DFCS took the family back to court, and the judge ruled that he was a deprived child, but inexplicably decided that he should remain with his mother, subject to certain conditions and limitations. But of course, Luttrell was unable to meet these conditions. So Jerry was readmitted to the hospital in Savannah after he threatened to kill one of his classmates. Then he was hospitalized for 11 days and discharged on no medications. I don't understand that. And given a referral to a community mental health program. So by the time this kid's 16, he's dropped out of school and he's spending his days drinking and smoking. He hung out with his older brothers. Both of them also had lengthy criminal records.
Yeah, and this is just kind of a horrible thing to read about.
Sure is.
You think, geez, they should be able to find some way to help this kid, but they just don't or can't.
Yeah, I don't know. It is a tragedy.
Yeah, I just can't. He's in court. He's ruled to be a deprived child. And then he's returned to his mother. And yes, there's conditions and limitations, but she didn't meet those. And as soon as that happens, you take him out of the house. But I don't know.
Well, how many chances are they going to give her when she's not really showing that she's changed at all?
No, she can't or won't.
So she's continued to be watched by DFCS, remember, because she has other kids. And this time, she was being monitored for her neglect of Joanna. And Joanna was removed from her home and placed in foster care with Kim and Danny Daniels. So that's where they come into this picture. And Joanna did really well in foster care. And she wanted the Daniels to meet Luttrell and Jerry.
Which they did. Well, just looking back when we were discussing this case earlier, this is where Kim invited Jerry to come stay with them so they could try to help him get clean and sober. And he seemed to be, you know, in his times that he was visiting, he seemed to be okay. He would play with the other kids. He'd draw pictures with them. He'd read to them, like 5-year-old books, but he would read, you know, playing in the pond, swimming. He seemed to be an okay kid.
Well, Joanna was really thriving in the Daniels house. She was there for about 12 weeks in 1995, and it was so much different from the home life she was used to. Even when she was returned to her mom, she had these really fond memories of the Daniels family. They treated me just like their own, she would say. But Jerry, he never really fit in anywhere, and his brief stay with the Daniels was no exception to this. He rarely spoke with anyone, preferring to stay outside and smoke. Now, he did seem more animated when Jessica was around, and that's Danny's teenage daughter. And Danny was aware of Jerry's interest in his daughter and was a little, you know, hesitant about that, was keeping an eye on him. But
a big, huge eye.
Yeah. But he didn't raise the issue with Jerry right away.
No, he didn't.
They were giving this guy a chance.
He wanted to give Jerry every chance he could, but he was going to keep a close eye on him. Because
sure.
Jerry, for his part, seemed to be taking more of an abnormal interest in Jessica.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, you have to look out for your kids.
I'm her father. I'm thinking, keeping an eye on you, kid.
Well, Luttrell was increasingly asking both the Pentecostal church and the Daniels family for assistance. And it was noted that she didn't always seem very appreciative. The Daniels, in fact, began to avoid her.
Yeah, she would ask for money, for food, gas money, things like that. And wasn't always real appreciative. And she hit up the Daniels a lot of times. Now, these people don't have much money themselves. He's a mail carrier. She's a stay-at-home mom.
Right. And then all they have is, you know, what they get for the foster kids, barely enough to take care of them.
I think I read that it was $11.50 per child per day.
Not a ton of money.
No. So, you know, they're on a tight budget anyway. And here's Joanna's mom hitting them up for more. So they just felt more and more uncomfortable around Luttrell and tried to avoid her as much as they could.
Sure. At some point, Jerry met a woman named Maria Spivey, and they began dating. And this was an odd relationship, because they could really be inseparable, or they could go weeks without seeing each other. But one thing was for certain, they were sexually active, because Maria gave birth to a baby boy named Joshua when she was 18. And even though he had no parenting experience, Jerry was said to be really great with kids.
At least at that time. Things changed, but yeah. I mean, one of his drinking buddies was a woman named Melinda Platcher, and she would even allow Jerry to babysit her kids.
Hmm.
So after the birth, Maria went home to live with her parents, but Jerry visited often. Now, Maria didn't want him spending time much at the Daniels house because she knew that there is a pretty teenager living there.
Jessica,
and she's worried that Jerry would be going after her.
That seems reasonable.
Doesn't it?
But at the same time, Danny didn't want Jerry around his daughter either. He confided to a friend that he was going to ask Jerry to leave. So both Danny and Kim had talked about it, and they realized that Jerry was still using drugs and alcohol. And there didn't seem to be much likelihood that he was going to get himself clean. He didn't seem like he was going down the right path. So they did make this decision to ask him to leave, not only for their own benefit, but for the benefit of the other children in the home.
No question. But it was apparent that Jerry wasn't making any attempt to come off of the drugs and alcohol. And drugs, I mean, it was marijuana. That was his drug of choice.
Yeah, but he's not working. He's not functioning.
No.
No,
he's not, from their standpoint, the Daniels' standpoint, Jerry's not doing anything to try to help himself.
Right.
So we got that, and then this maybe too much interest in the teenage daughter can see where they'd want him out of the house.
I think it's their only responsible thing to do, really.
Yeah.
So mid-November, after finishing his postal route, Danny stopped at the trailer where Jerry was living, and he told Jerry that he could no longer come to their house. And this was the last time either of them spoke to one another. Jerry's reaction to this was his usual unresponsive kind of blank stare, and his mother, Luttrell, became furious about it. Now, she retaliated against the Daniels by making donuts with her car on their lawn, so destroying their lawn. Just kind of crazy, huh?
Isn't it?
I don't like this Luttrell at all. Psycho lady.
That's the idea she came up with.
And several months earlier, Jerry found out he was going to be a father again, so this was going to be his second child with Maria, and she was due in late November.
Yeah, now, there's some question about whether he was the father or not. He was kidded a lot about this.
Oh.
He chose to believe that he was the father, and Maria didn't do anything to make him think otherwise.
All right. So he still wasn't working because of this heart surgery, which doesn't make much sense.
Well, the heart surgery, like we said, was an excuse. So, I can't do this job because I had heart surgery.
Well, he spent nights at different places, and days he would just drink and smoke weed, hitting all the places where he could score free alcohol or marijuana. And one of his favorite places to hang out was at Jerry Johnson's house. Jerry was almost 60 years old. He was a paraplegic from a car accident.
Yeah, so he was wheelchair bound.
Mm-hmm. And he had this house that was always open to people who wanted to drink and play pool. So Jerry was a frequent guest there, and as was his pattern, he took notice of everything there. He knew where Johnson parked his van. He knew where the keys were. He knew how Johnson locked up the house at night. So he's got some criminal ideas.
Yeah, Johnson had this elaborate method for getting his house ready for the night. So when he was tired, and this didn't matter if people were still there playing pool or what, the pool table was kind of out on a porch.
Okay.
So when Mr. Johnson was ready for bed, he would lock up the place. Even with people outside playing pool and stuff, he'd go in, he'd lock up, and he had an electric wheelchair. So all his doors were locked except one. He had a cord running into that doorway, so the door didn't close all the way. So he put his 100-something-pound wheelchair in that doorway. Uh-huh. So that was the lock on that door, was the wheelchair.
That doesn't seem foolproof.
It's not.
No.
But that's what he would do. And so you could be sitting around shooting pool and stuff, and all of a sudden, Mr. Johnson says, "Goodnight, boys," and he'd go in. I mean, you could still play pool and stuff. You just couldn't get into his house.
I could see that. So in October 1997, Jerry borrowed a car, and he was arrested for DUI because he was drunk. He was sentenced to 40 hours of community service and fined $1,400.
Yeah, now $1,400 is a sum of money he's never going to be able to come up with.
It's beyond him, yeah. But I think this is also before there was a real crackdown on DUI. And that was kind of a mild punishment compared to what happens nowadays.
Yeah, it wouldn't be community service.
No. Now, 1 month later, he was arrested again, this time for stealing a Jeep as well as a four-wheeler. His old caseworker, aware of his recent difficulties, asked Latrell if she wanted to help get Jerry into treatment. And she said she would talk to Jerry.
Yeah, there's no evidence she ever did. But she said she'd look into it.
Well, in November 29th, 1997, Jerry went to visit his pregnant girlfriend, Maria, and she was due any time. And on the day that he visited, she felt very ill. So Jerry said she needed to be in the hospital.
Yeah, this is one instance where Jerry took charge.
Okay.
I don't know how, because he just kind of floated through life doing nothing. But then he sees his pregnant girlfriend is about ready to pop a baby out. She's due. He says, "We got to go to the hospital." Good for him.
Yeah, she was sick.
She was.
So they drove to Bacon County Hospital, and Maria was admitted. There were complications with the pregnancy, and the baby had a very irregular heartbeat. So does Jerry's condition, could that be inherited?
Well, I couldn't find exactly what he had. I'm thinking that since it involved the mitral valve, that he had mitral valve prolapse. And that can be a heritable condition. We don't know for sure. I'm just kind of guessing.
All right. Well, that night, Jerry was alone with Maria, and he wrote her a poem titled In the Arms of God. Shortly after he'd written the poem, the baby's heart monitor stopped beeping. So Maria was taken into another room where she delivered a baby boy, and this baby only lived for an hour. So we're not sure exactly why?
No, we're not. It was declared a stillbirth. And cause of death was cardiac arrest.
So I wonder if she had some kind of infection, because that would do it, right?
It sure would.
Well, the funeral for that baby was held December 2nd, 1997. And Jerry was uncharacteristically emotional at this service, sobbing uncontrollably. He spent the next day with Maria and her family, playing with her siblings, smoking, and just picking at his food. Later in the day, he asked Maria to drive him to his mother's. And she later said that he seemed even more depressed than he usually was. At his mother's, he was asked a lot of questions about the dead baby, and he became really angry. So he started drinking. And in the evening, he decided to go over to Jerry Johnson's, where he continued drinking. And they said he was very verbal there.
Yeah, he kept talking about the dead baby.
So this is an issue for him. He's having trouble with this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after Johnson had gone to bed and done his ritual, Jerry and another guy played pool for a little while longer. Now, when the game was over and the other man had left, Jerry took Johnson's keys, and he drove his van in the direction of Santa Claus. Now, this was past midnight.
Yeah, so he He went to the door with the wheelchair, and he was able to get it cracked open just a little bit. And Jerry was this little, well, he was tall, but he was a skinny guy. So he was able to wiggle himself into the house, steal Jerry Johnson's keys, and take off in his van.
So this is a disaster. He drove the van to the Daniels driveway, shut it off, and stood next to it, finished his beer, threw the can on the ground, smoked a cigarette, tossed the butt on the ground.
So we got DNA evidence.
Yeah, right.
That he was there.
He found a stepladder, moved it to a bathroom window, and wriggled his way through that window. And once he was inside, he was in no hurry. He cracked the back door and smoked a couple more cigarettes. The second one he smashed out on the carpet in the house. He walked back to the bedroom, stopping at the gun cabinet, and took out an 1100 Remington shotgun. After he loaded the gun, he stepped into the bedroom, and he shot Danny in the chest. Then he shot Kim. Now, he apparently didn't kill Danny with the first shot, so he shot him again. Then Jerry walked down the hallway into the boys' bedroom. He shot little Bryant, one of the twins, point blank in the head. Then Corey, hiding in the closet, didn't get hurt. He avoided getting shot. So from the bedroom, he walked back to the bathroom. And there he was confronted by Jessica, the teenager. She ran from the bathroom toward her parents' bedroom. But Jerry followed and shot her in the back of the head. And then he shot Danny again. So
pretty cold.
Massacre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he walked through the house and he's going through the rooms. He's switching on all the lights as he's going through the rooms. And he collected Amanda, Amber, and Brooke. So Amber and Brooke are the Daniels kids. Amanda's one of their foster kids. He herded the girls into the van. He was telling them that he was saving them from an intruder. Now, the oldest one's only like 11 years old, so they're scared out of their minds anyway. And they knew Jerry as Scott.
Right.
And they trusted him, so they got into his van. Now, he left behind Corey, who was 4, and a little baby Gabriel, and the 4 dead bodies.
Now, these little girls were dressed in only their nightgowns, and of course, they were frightened. They had no idea what was going on. Jerry soon dropped this ruse and told the girls that he was kidnapping them, and this was very confusing. The man they knew as Scott Taylor had been a friend who enjoyed playing with them.
Crossing the Altamaha River, Jerry tossed the shotgun in the water, and it never got recovered. He stopped the van once and got out, and the girls took this opportunity to try to escape. But he caught them.
Yeah. Well, in the Shattered episode on this case, on ID, he had caught one girl and then told the other girls if they don't come back, he's going to throw that one in the river. So then they listened to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he got them back in the van. He drove around. He parked on a quiet lane. He took one of the girls to the back of the van and raped her.
I think that was Amber.
That was Amber. Then he started on a second girl, but stopped. For some unknown reason, and eventually he let them off and drove away. He said, you know, I could kill you girls, but I'm going to leave you here.
Well, in Amber's interview, she said that he said he'd be back.
Right.
Yeah. But they were lucky enough to find a house with lights on, a farmhouse, and the couple there let them in and called the police, so they were saved.
They were. So the police learned from the girls that the man they knew as Scott Taylor was the one who had abducted them from the home in Santa Claus. So the police in the county they were in called the Toombs County Sheriff's Office. And this led to Deputy Michael Harlan driving out to the Daniels house at 5 o'clock in the morning. So first thing he sees when he arrives was that the front door was ajar.
Now, aren't you surprised a little bit that they sent him alone? He'd only been on the force for less than a year.
Yeah, but at the time, they didn't know that there were dead bodies there.
Well, sure, but people had been kidnapped, so they knew it was a pretty big crime. So this was a nightmare for him.
I can't imagine. I would be so scared.
Yeah, right?
Growing up there. Particularly, I get there and the door's ajar. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, something's not right here.
Yeah, so he ran into the 4-year-old, Corey, who told him, Mama and Daddy are dead. So Harlan entered the bedroom and he saw Bryant lying in the top bunk with blood and brain matter all over the place. That child had been shot. And in the master bedroom, he found the remains of Danny, Kim, and Jessica. Now, baby Gabriel was alive, and he was still in his crib in the master bedroom, crying, in a room with, what, three dead bodies?
Three dead bodies, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Now, the two boys were reunited with their sisters, and before the police could tell them, Corey blurted out, "Mommy and Daddy are dead." So that's how the girls found out. The girls all identified Jerry Scott Heidler, a.k.a. Scott Taylor, as the person who had abducted them. And around this same time, Jerry Johnson reported his van being stolen, and Jerry Scott Heidler, of course, was the culprit.
Yeah, so we have the girl's story that a guy named Scott Taylor abducted them, and Jerry Johnson's story that Jerry Scott Heidler stole his van. They thought that there might be a connection between the two, but they had two different names.
I see. Yeah. Well, this Amber, the girl who was sexually assaulted, what a brave girl she was.
Wasn't she?
Yeah.
She gave such a detailed history.
And she was so together. I mean, we saw footage from her being interviewed afterwards.
Yeah.
Just a really strong person.
Incredible. So they eventually figured out that Jerry Scott Heidler was Scott Taylor. And they eventually learned that Jerry Scott Heidler lived in that area. So they sent an agent from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation over to Luttrell's house. And lo and behold, the van's parked right out front.
Wow.
No attempt to drive it somewhere else or hide it or get rid of it or anything. Just sitting right there. So Agent Rowe calls for backup, which arrives. They had the local police watching the back of the house or the trailer. And they went inside and didn't find him, but they had seen him. So they eventually found out some floorboards were loose and he was hiding under the trailer in that little kind of crawl space area.
So, of course, he's arrested. And during the interrogation, he admitted to the murders and the abductions. When news of this reached the citizens of the area, they were very relieved because there was a murderer on the loose. Some offered alternative solutions to putting Jerry in jail. One man said, "If the police would just let him go, I can guarantee it'll be taken care of real fast. They'd never know who killed him, but they'd get a call where to find that punk's messed up body." So, a lot of hatred there.
Well, and again, this is kind of the culture of the area.
Yep.
We handle things this way.
Yep.
So.
Southern. So the funerals for the Daniels family were held on December 8th, and over 600 people attended. So it was apparent that the Daniels were really well-loved in Santa Claus. The Reverend Wood and his wife were inconsolable. And of course, the children were as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, also on that same day, Jerry made his first court appearance, and he was charged with 4 counts of murder, 3 counts of kidnapping, and 1 count of burglary.
Yeah, now when he actually did go to trial, the molestation charges were added to that.
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah. So he got charged with a whole bunch of stuff.
So he was asked if he understood that the maximum penalty for his crimes was death, and he replied that he had no questions about it. A court-appointed attorney, Kathy Palmer, represented him, as well as another attorney who had some death penalty experience, named Michael Garrett. So after many pretrial hearings, a change of venue was ordered, and the trial would be held in Monroe, Georgia. Time dragged on until the trial began, and Jerry was becoming quite a nuisance in the jail.
He was quite clever, actually. I mean, besides the multiple behavior issues, he could remove locks from doors and was also able to rewire the smoke alarm in his cell so he could make it appear as if a fire was happening in a different section of the jail.
Wow, that is impressive.
He's familiar with things. He also somehow found materials to tattoo himself. I don't think that's so impressive.
No, I think that happens a lot.
Yeah. And then when jailers tried to ignore his activities, he'd get worse.
So he was kind of acting out.
Absolutely.
They said he also had a really good memory, and it was amazing some of the things he actually knew. So he wasn't really a dummy.
No.
He was just disturbed. So Jerry's trial was to begin in the fall of 1999. He was ordered to undergo a psychological assessment prior to trial, and this was done at the hospital in Savannah. That's the same place where he was twice hospitalized when he was a teenager. So this report ended with 3 major findings. 1, it is our opinion that Mr. Heidler is competent to proceed to trial on the charges specified. 2, it is our opinion that Mr. Heidler knew right from wrong. He was not suffering from a mental disorder. 3, it is our opinion that there is ample mitigating evidence which may be used by the court in its disposition phase of the trial. And this evidence could also support a finding of guilty but mentally ill.
Yeah, because they've already said basically you can't use insanity as a defense.
Okay.
Because they said that he was competent to proceed to trial and he knew right from wrong. So he didn't fit the definition of insanity.
No, he probably didn't.
But at the same time, they said, well, you could find him guilty, but mentally ill.
I don't understand the specifics of that, why that is the way it works.
I don't know either. But
another something for one of our lawyers to tell us about.
I think it would mitigate things a little bit.
Sure. Well, I mean, also he was taking notes in the jailhouse routine and knew exactly when the bed checks happened. And he had hidden a small blade in his mattress, which we don't know where he got that. So each night he worked on sawing through the 2 bars on his window. This was meticulous, slow going, and he would hide this activity by mixing a paste of toothpaste and cigarette ashes and applying that to the bars to kind of show the gray color, so you couldn't see where he'd been sawing. So on July 6, 1989, Jerry made his move. It was in early morning hours. He pushed the cut bars aside, popped open the window, and wriggled through this 10 by 10 opening. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Was he that skinny?
Mm-hmm.
He created an opening in the perimeter and he was free. His disappearance was noted when the guards made their 5 a.m. rounds and an APB was issued. Now the entire area was frightened, of course, that he had escaped. This is a mass murderer. And he knew where the abducted girls were staying. Or he might head to his mother's, or he could go after the attorneys. Nobody knows what's going on in this guy's head. But fortunately, he was recaptured just walking down the middle of Highway 15 near Vidalia. He was soaked with sweat, really tired, scratches and bleeding on his arms and legs. He had escaped only wearing his boxers and a t-shirt. So he really wasn't prepared. He was just eaten alive by bugs. It was a miserable situation.
He basically gave himself back up.
Yeah.
And he apparently didn't have any idea what he was going to do when he escaped. I guess he was incapable of thinking beyond anything. So he figured out how to escape.
Yeah, but it's hard to be on the lam.
But then didn't have any idea what he was going to do after he escaped.
Well, it just reminds me of Ted Bundy. When he escaped and they found him, he was like suffering from malnutrition, looked like a mess.
Yeah.
So once back in jail, plans were made to transfer Jerry to the Walton County Jail, where the trial was to be held, and that jail was more escape-proof. But he continued some bizarre behavior. He listed his name as Sandman and his address as 666-Hell. He listed his religion as Devil Child. His next of kin was Satan. One of his statements was, "I've killed and I'll kill again. I'm not through collecting souls. I'm the soul collector." And as this trial was ready to begin, both the prosecution and the defense ratcheted up their games. The prosecution had all the evidence of Jerry's bizarre behavior since being transferred to the Walton County Jail, and the defense had the information from 2 independent therapists that Jerry could be considered guilty but mentally ill.
Yes, they've got all these bizarre behaviors to show how weird Jerry was.
But maybe he was doing that on purpose.
Could have been. But the concern would be that if he didn't receive the death penalty, that at some point he could be paroled and he could go after people.
Sure.
So the trial itself was almost an anticlimax. It lasted less than 2 weeks. The jurors were chosen on like a Monday or Tuesday, and one of them asked how long they could expect to be sequestered for the trial. And the judge said by the end of next week.
Oh, so they knew it would be quick.
So they didn't think it was going to last too long.
Okay.
So less than 2 weeks of trial, of testimony. And then the amazing thing is the jury deliberated for a little over half an hour. I mean, boom.
Yeah.
They found Jerry guilty on all counts. So then the penalty phase began shortly after the guilty finding, and Jerry was sentenced to death by electrocution.
So in October 2001, the Georgia Supreme Court declared that death by electrocution amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. So as of today, Jerry Scott Heidler remains on death row, And I guess he's been found too mentally unstable to execute. Is that what we read?
Yeah, isn't that some kind of catch-22?
Yeah.
You know, he's been found guilty of this and sentenced to death, but at the same time, he's too mentally unstable to kill.
Hmm. Well, today's episode is sponsored by Mira Books and Hunting Annabelle by Wendy Hurd. Sean Saw is done with killing. After 3 years in a psychiatric prison, he's determined to stay away from temptation. But he can't resist Annabelle. Who alone can see past the monster to the man inside? Then Annabelle disappears. This is a chilling, deeply suspenseful page-turner. And it's set in the 1980s. Hunting Annabelle by Wendy Hurd is available now wherever books are sold. Give in to temptation today and give it a read.
I will. The music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel.
Yes, thank you, Tristan. If you want more TCB, you can go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber for access to our members-only episodes. You can also go to Patreon, become a patron, and get the same benefits. In November, we covered the murders at White House Farm, and other members-only episodes include the case of Diane Downs, Robert Fisher, who killed his family and is still missing, and there are about 20 more episodes.
Yeah, don't forget the OJ series.
Oh yeah, that was fun. Now for our special Christmas edition on the Members Only feed, we're going to be watching and podcasting about one of our favorite Christmas love stories, The Family Man. And this is starring Tia Leone and Nicolas Cage, the king of overacting. So we thought that would be a really fun little break from crime. So that's what we're doing, and that's coming up soon.
Yeah, we'll be getting that out pretty quickly.
Yep. So let's move forward with feedback. Remember, you can send feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or you can tell us in your own voice by leaving a voicemail on the Leave a Voicemail link on the right side of our website. If you submit a voicemail before the end of the year, and if we play it on an episode, even in 2019, we're going to send you an absolutely free True Crime Brewery t-shirt. Now, one last note, if you click on Shop the Brewery at tiegrabber.com, you're going to see that we have a new link to a TeePublic store where you can get lots of items with TCB logos. There are various logos, and there's items, t-shirts, hoodies, laptop cases, stickers, just all kinds of swaggy stuff.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah. All right, so let's start with the voicemails.
Okay, I got you three.
Okay.
First one's from Beth, and she has a case suggestion.
Okay, let's hear what Beth had to say.
Hi, guys. This is Beth from Florida. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoy your show. It's great entertainment late at night. I just found it, and I'm trying to get caught up on all the shows. Anyway, I just wanted to make a suggestion. In this area, Seminole Heights, we had a serial killer 2017 from October to November, and his name was Howard Donaldson III. He terrorized the neighborhood for that 6-week period and randomly killed 4 people. The neighborhood was terrified. They had extra police patrolling. People were staying inside at night, keeping their porch lights on. There was apparently no rhyme or reason to his selection of victims. They did get some video footage and were able to get that on the news, but it was really blurry, so you couldn't tell. What led to his arrest was the fact that he turned his gun into his manager who worked at a McDonald's, and the manager called the police. He was arrested and has been charged with the deaths of these 4 people. My suggestion for a drink is not a beer. It is a really good spiced rum from a local brewery, St. Pete Distillery, which would be great for Christmas time. I hope you all have a good Christmas. Thank you.
Okay, so Dick's making a face about the rum.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
But I love to have some almond or soy nog with some spiced rum, so I would enjoy it for the holidays.
Yeah.
I think I'll drink some while we're doing the Family Man podcast.
Yeah, all I'd say is it's True Crime Brewery. not True Crime Distillery.
Okay.
But it's a good idea. Although Tampa's got Cigar City Brewing, so I'm sure I could find...
We've done Cigar City lots, though.
I know.
Okay. We can make an exception for Christmas because we are going to do a podcast about a movie. So we are breaking the crime thing. We could break the beer thing a little, too.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about a beer for that.
Yeah, maybe we could do the rum for that. We'll see. Thank you for the suggestions, Beth. So what do we know about the case that Beth suggested?
Well, Beth pretty much gave the synopsis of it. So this guy, Howell Emanuel Donaldson III, started his spree of shootings on October 9th in the Seminole Heights neighborhood of Tampa. He was arrested following the shootings. He was accused of killing Benjamin Mitchell, age 22, Monica Hoffa, age 32, Anthony Nyboa, age 20, and Ronald Felton, age 60.
So did he know these people?
Nope, completely random.
Okay, but they did capture him on the surveillance footage.
Yeah, but the video, all the tips, or the big reward, nothing of those amounted to anything.
Okay.
But they eventually, as Beth said, bullet casings, because the idiot turned in his revolver or his gun to a friend, and this person turned it into the police.
So. But it took a while to catch him because they were on high alert on Halloween a few weeks later. So he was on the loose for a while. That would be terrifying for the community.
Yeah, well, yeah. If you've got someone sort of like Son of Sam in New York.
Yeah.
Just totally random killings.
Right.
That'd put the whole community on edge, wouldn't it?
Yep.
But it's an interesting thing.
Well, they found bullet casings at all four crime scenes, so they were able to know it was his gun pretty easily.
They got him.
Yeah. So now we have a voicemail from Chris.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Chris from Syracuse, New York. First, I wanted to say you guys are doing a great job with the podcast. Now, even though some of the content is kind of gruesome or macabre, I find it extremely interesting, especially Dick's medical input, considering that my mom was a nurse for over 30 years, and that kind of inured me to some things. But aside from that, near where I live in Syracuse, there was a guy named John Jamelski who had built a dungeon kind of in his backyard. Well, not really in his backyard, under his backyard. And over the course of a few years, he had kidnapped, I think, at least five women, you know, five that I guess we know of. And at one point, he might have been suspected of killing his wife, but I don't know if the police ever investigated that. But in any case, that's something that happened near where I live. Jamelski used to live in a place called DeWitt, New York, which is close by me. And I drive by his former house every day when I go to work. So just wanted to mention that to you guys, see if you had heard of it or if you didn't notice if you had done a story on it or not. But his story was kind of used as a prologue story for one episode of Law and Order, and it was referenced in an episode of Criminal Minds. But in any case, keep up the good work, and enjoy your time in your new home. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Yeah, nice
note,
Chris.
That was nice, yeah. So, John Thomas Jamelski. So this is a serial rapist kidnapper from 1988 to when he was apprehended in 2003. He kidnapped a series of girls and women and held them captive in a concrete bunker beneath his yard, as Chris said, in a suburb of Syracuse, New York. So in October 1988, he abducted his first victim, who was a 14-year-old Native American girl, and she was held captive for over 2 years. And she turned 17 by the time of her release. So if you can imagine what life was like for that girl, I can't.
Nope.
But Jamelski compelled her to his will by threatening violence against her younger brother. So she made no attempt to report him. In either 95 or 96, he abducted a 14-year-old Latina runaway, whom he lured under the premise of paying her to deliver a package. Now this girl willingly walked into his bunker, which he called the dungeon, and he closed the door behind her. It's like a horror movie. Eventually, he put a blindfold on her and drove her to her mother's apartment and dropped her off. Although her family was also threatened, she did go to the police with a description. But because of her previous drug use, they questioned the credibility of her story, and they dropped the investigation shortly after that. Then in August 1997, he kidnapped a 53-year-old Vietnamese woman off the street She was a foreign refugee who spoke very little English, and he forced her into his car and took her to an abandoned home where he raped her. Then he tied her to a stack of flattened cardboard boxes and drove her to his house. And during her captivity, she was raped daily and also forced to fulfill various menial tasks for him. She was released on May 23, 1998 at a Greyhound bus station with $50. And she reported to the police that day, but nothing came of that. She claimed that the police didn't believe her, but Syracuse police spokesman Sergeant Thomas Connellan stated that they investigated all the leads and nothing panned out. But then on May 11, 2001, a 26-year-old Caucasian woman walking in downtown Syracuse while on LSD was offered a ride home by Jamelski, which the woman accepted due to the poor weather. Now he took her back to his bunker where he raped her daily, and when she resisted, he would inflict cigar burns on her body, and she developed an abscess on her lower back from that. He also manipulated her with claims that he was part of an underground slavery syndicate. So the victim wanted to write home to her parents, letting them know she was alive, and while he did agree, she could only do so in stating that she was in a drug rehab clinic.
Yeah, but eventually these stories started getting a little more believed by people, and they arrested him.
He did seem to pick vulnerable people that might not be believed. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Interesting case.
Well, thanks again, Chris. And our next voicemail is from Tina.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Tina, and I'm in California. I just wanted to say how much I love your podcast. I've been a Team Tie Grabber for a couple of years now. I wanted to do a case suggestion for a teenager named Cassie Jo Stoddard. I'm sorry, I don't know where this took place at, but she was murdered by two of her classmates who, when she was house-sitting, snuck into the house, put on masks, and stabbed her to death. What is really scary about this is that there is a video recording of them talking about how they were going to kill her, and then there's also footage of after the murder of them bragging about killing her. I just watched an episode of Copycat Killers regarding this case. I believe it's on Oxygen, the Oxygen channel, but I wanted to hear your guys' take on it. It's really scary to me how the kids just decided... teenagers just decided to record this, and then after they killed her, they bragged about it. Anyway, I really love your podcast, and I look forward to your new episodes every week. Thank you.
Thanks, Tina. Now, I think this case has actually been on our radar, hasn't it?
It has been. So this occurred in Idaho. Brian Lee Draper and Tori Michael Adamczyk were arrested and convicted of the first-degree murder of Cassie Jo Stoddard. This is in September 2006. And they received mandatory life sentences without parole. 10 years later, 2016, the United States Supreme Court ruled that such a mandatory sentence for a crime committed as a juvenile was unconstitutional, even for a person who committed murder. So it directed state courts to review sentences for all persons covered under this ruling. And that included Draper and Adamczyk. Because of their youth and the premeditation of their crime, these two young men had been studied during and since their convictions. They were covered in a 2013 documentary, Lost for Life, about persons convicted and imprisoned as juveniles who are serving mandatory life sentences. Their stories have been featured on BBC Three's Teen Killers, Life Without Parole, which was originally on TV in April of 2014. They were also featured on Investigation Discovery's Your Worst Nightmare, which was in October of 2014. So there's just a lot of publicity about this. It's an interesting, controversial topic.
Well, yeah, I think the whole ruling about juveniles getting a mandatory life sentence, we've run into that before in other cases. So it's definitely worth talking about.
Yeah, we might have to do that. I'll see what I can find out.
Okay, so we have a couple of emails to get to as well. Let's do that.
Yeah, we have a couple case suggestions and a comment that I thought was very interesting. So,
okay, the first one's from Nikki. It's a case suggestion. And Nikki says, can you cover the Hurricane Katrina New Orleans murder-suicide of Addie Hall by Zach Bowen? After he killed and butchered her, he cooked her. Then he went to a hotel and jumped off the roof to his death. This case hasn't been widely covered, and I'd love to hear your take on it. Thanks so much. Yeah, I've never heard of that. Have you? Before
no,
this?
I hadn't heard of this one at all.
All right. So good find, Nikki.
So yeah, this is after Katrina, and the couple were one of the few people that didn't evacuate.
So this was back in 2006. Can you believe it's been that long since Katrina?
Yeah, can you? So and after Katrina, they would offer rescuers and helpers, you know, come on in, have a beer, take it easy.
Who did?
Addie and Zach.
Oh, at their house?
Yeah. Addie liked to flash her breasts at people walking by.
Well, it is New Orleans. Okay.
So in October 2006, the police responded to the Omni Hotel in New Orleans because a man had jumped to his death from the roof. So the guy who did this was Zach Bowen, and in his pocket they found a note telling them where they could find the dismembered remains of his girlfriend, Addie Hall. So Zach had strangled her, dismembered the body, and cooked some of it in the oven, not to eat apparently, but just to make identification more difficult.
Oh, well, that's heinous.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. And the next email is from Cindy. It's another case suggestion. Cindy says, I worked in a hospital environment for 22 years as a medical transcriptionist, and I'm interested in the case of Dr. Michael Swango. I read the book Blind Eye by James Stewart. These patients who came under Swango's care came into the hospital for routine operations, and he poisoned them. Also, while in med school, he botched his cadaver and had some crazy way of taking tests, which one of the professors called swangoing. To show how weird this guy was, he kept scrapbooks for gory scenes, like motor vehicle accidents. He was also a habitual bald-faced liar on job applications, but you can read all of this for yourself. He may have murdered as many as 60 patients. And while working as an EMT, he tried to poison his co-workers. Fortunately, no one of them died. He poisoned someone's Coke at a Ohio Buckeye football game and poisoned donuts that he brought in one day. I'm anxious to hear your input on this case as well as the other cases that I have mentioned. So Cindy's written to us before.
She has. I've read the book, Blind Eye.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, and that's what got me interested in this guy, Swango. He's pretty prolific. And I would expect that sometime in the coming 2019 year, we will do him.
I think it's great because you're someone who's gone to med school, so you can kind of give us some comparisons of how things go and how weird he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Cindy.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that because I had that in the back of my head that I wanted to do that case.
So now we have a comment on Dark Water by Sunita. And Sunita writes, I'm not sure if this has been covered already with other listener comments, but you mentioned Aliza Lamb was on medications that were blister-packed. I am a pharmacist in British Columbia, Canada, and can tell you that this does not mean she was taking doctor's samples. Blister-packed medications are a card that has plastic pockets with 4 slots daily, a.m., noon, supper, bedtime, and 7 days of the week, filled with the associated medications. It is often used for psychiatric patients and or the elderly or people who have challenges adhering to simplify the medication process and minimize missed or incorrect doses. So Aliza was very likely not started on 4 drugs at once. I would question the clinical acumen and rationale in doing this. I work with psychiatrists and do not know one who would do this. So without knowing her medical record, I can almost 100% assure you that these 4 drugs were not all just recently started on or started all at once. One of the drugs may have recently been decreased or increased. However, I thought I'd clarify that point for you regarding blister-packed medications. Love your show. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Sunita. I don't know if we were aware of that. We were kind of unaware of the whole blister-pack situation.
Yeah, no, I mean, my experience has been if it's a blister-pack, it's a sample. And that's how I was presenting it when we were discussing Dark Water. But now I know that at least some places use them to simplify dosing.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah. It just shows another way that Canada's ahead of us in healthcare.
But that was a very timely comment. So thank you, Sunita.
I appreciate that. Whenever someone can clarify something we're stupid about, it's great.
It is, isn't it?
Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you everyone for your voicemails, your comments, and your suggestions. And we will see you next time at the Quiet End. Have a great week.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.